Earth and Sky.
Welcome to Clear Voices. I'm Jorge Salazar. The next big thing in computing looks to be quantum computing, using individual atoms to store and manipulate information. But what's the state of quantum computing and what lies ahead? I spoke with two experts on quantum computing at Intel Corporation, George Borjanov, Manager of External Research in Nanoelectronics and Nanotechnology, and Paolo Gargini, Director of Technology Strategy and an Intel Fellow. Here's Drs. Borjanov and Gargini.
Well, Drs. Gargini and Borjanov, welcome to Earth and Sky.
Thank you very much.
To start with, I'd like to talk a little bit about nanotechnology and what impact it's making in the field of electronics right now.
Yeah, so this is Paolo. Let me start addressing the subject. At the very heart of the semiconductor industry has been the reduction in feature size, and that applies to either, you know, vertical dimension or horizontal dimension. Just to give you an idea, approximately in 1970, the thickness of the oxide, one of the films used as the fundamental film used in making the MOS transistor, was about 100 nanometer at that time. And the length of the gate, meaning the distance that the electrons had to travel from source to drain to operate the switch, was at that time about 10 microns, that is 10,000 nanometers. The thickness of the oxide had gotten from the 100 nanometer to about 1.5, 1.4 nanometer, reduction, give or take, of about 100. And the length of the gate from the 10,000 nanometer of the 1970s had gotten to about 190 nanometer, reduction again of about 100. And the benefits, as you can imagine, as everything becomes smaller, the distance you have to travel going from A to B becomes much shorter, so you can expect the device will work faster. But in addition to that, we made some adjustments in our devices whereby not only they are smaller and work faster, but actually when they're not supposed to be operational, they actually consume less what we call standby power, because indeed we are introducing new films and new elements in our devices, still a dimension of 1 or 2 nanometers or 3 nanometers or so. They have better properties. For instance, the oxide that I mentioned before, that is on the top of the silicon device and is controlled by an upper gate, has the benefit of controlling without touching the underlying silicon, but some leakage, between the upper gate and the silicon exists. But by replacing it nowadays with more advanced material, we were able actually to limit this kind of leakage. So these are more the classical elements of nanotechnology that automatically come into play into the semiconductor industry.
Dr. Borjanov, what are your thoughts here?
Okay, well, I think one of the fundamentals that we have to go back and re-examine is what we mean by information and how we store information and how we manipulate it. The transistors up to now have used groups of electrons, presence or absence of a charge, as we call it, or the presence or absence of an electric current to store information. And that's what we've manipulated up to now. There are many ways, however, of storing information. The ancient Persians stored information by the position of beads on a string, and that gave rise to the abacus. And that was one way of storing information, and then they just manipulated those beads on the string, and they could do some elementary calculations. If you zoom forward in time, 3,500 years, to where we are now, there are many other ways of storing information or storing computational state, as we call it. One of the extreme examples of that is quantum computing. And that's a very extreme example of that, which we're not going to see for another 50 years probably. But there are some intermediate ways of storing information that are quite attractive, and we are pursuing as an industry research into that. One of those has to do with basically how you store information in crystal structures. A perfect crystal has no degrees of freedom, so you cannot store information in it. if you go back to the idea of distinguishability being the fundamental unit of information, in other words, if you can distinguish two things as being different from each other, something red, something blue, something up, something down, that has information in it. But a perfect crystal doesn't have information in it. It's all perfect. It's all completely uniform. So the way nature gets information into crystals is basically putting impurities of various sorts into the crystal structure. And then you can have information by how those impurities are grouped and the arrangement of them, and you can manipulate those to store information. And by doing that, you can change the atomic structure of a small crystal or crystalline film so that it has different properties, magnetic properties, different electrical properties, and sometimes, in some cases, both of those are correlated with each other. So what we're doing is really looking at some of the alternative ways of storing information and manipulating it, which has potential advantages in terms of energy consumption, power, in other words, and potential advantages in terms of speed, and potential advantages just in terms of information density. So we as an industry are working hard with our colleagues in the academic community to develop some of these ideas and reduce them to practice and have a device or a circuit that really makes use of these. And we're not there yet, but there are some things that we see which have a higher probability prior to getting to the extreme case of quantum computing that I mentioned.
Well, Dr. Boriana, may I follow up with that? You talked about the abacus and 3,500 years later and even 50 years in the future of this quantum computing. Is this going to make what we're doing with the computers we use now look, are they going to seem like the abacus of yesterday? And what role is nanotechnology playing in quantum computing? What is it? What are we talking about here?
Okay, well, quantum computing, it all gets back to the idea of how we store information. With quantum mechanics, we began to understand how individual atoms are composed. And one of the fundamental contributions of quantum mechanics is to define or describe the condition of an atom in terms of a set of quantum numbers. There are basically four quantum numbers that can describe most atoms with satisfactory detail. So for each atom, there are 4 degrees of freedom that you can manipulate. And quantum computing comes about when you start manipulating those individual quantum numbers. But more importantly, it comes about when you put 2 or 3 or 4 atoms together with each other so that they all interact. And their complexity, the complexity of their group of atoms, expands very, very rapidly with the number of atoms. In other words, 3 atoms would have 8 times as much complexity or the ability to store information as the 3 individual atoms alone. So, and it goes up as a very high power of the number of atoms. So manipulating those entangled states, and that's what that's called when atoms interact with each other, they form entangled states. That's the whole basis of quantum computing. Now, the problem with quantum computing is trying to isolate a set of atoms sufficiently so that you can manipulate it with external fields or some other way and not have the noise inherent in any physical system destroy the quantum state you're trying to manipulate. And that's a very, very big challenge for the industry. And I'm not sure the industry is ever going to get to full quantum computing. I think it can get to some of the intermediate states involving magnetic fields or dielectric fields or combinations of those, which are called multiferroic fields. But quantum computing, the principal challenge is isolating the set of atoms that you want to try to manipulate from the rest of its environment, because that's physically impossible. Atoms cannot exist in a vacuum, or well, they can, but then you can't manipulate them. So that's, I think, a broad brush overview of what quantum computing is and where we are.
So, Mr. Salazar, let me put it somewhat in context for our audience. during the past 30 years, to give you an example, we have manipulated essentially electrons. And just to give you an example, imagine that each one of the memory cells is the size of a football field. And now you divide it in left and right, and you have 50,000 people in the middle of the football field. So if all the people are staying on the right-hand side, this represents a one. If all the people are staying on the left-hand side, this represents nominally a zero or another different kind of information. And as time has gone by, since we're making these cells, this equivalent of the football field, smaller and smaller, progressively they have become like a basketball court. So we cannot afford to put 50,000 people. We come down to 10,000, 1,000. And the direction we're going, we are now, we can put only 100 people on one side or the other. Going to this quantum computing and nano world, we're now looking at, can a single person, can an individual represent the information? And so if we have a very small location, the fact that the person is standing upright or upside down, does that give you the same information, either standing up or sitting down? Still gives you binary information. And so just to give you an idea, we've gone from manipulating large quantity of electrons, for instance, and using this element to store information, to now identifying as if we had a single person, due to the way the person dresses, if he moves the arms and so forth. And these are really the quantum variables that Dr. Buryanov is talking about. We're changing completely in the style from number of people to quality in a single person.
Well, Dr. Garjini, I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. One of the things that is the hallmark of nanotechnology is that when you start looking at these small spaces, this material, these small little groups of people are doing remarkable things that isn't apparent in looking at the big crowd.
The fundamental change is, while in the past we were moving, the 50,000 people from left to right. Now we're looking at the quality of the person and the details of the environment. Whereas in the past we built a device with many, many building blocks, now the fundamental building block is becoming the material itself. Materials are made of atoms, electrons, and so forth. And just looking at the way the material itself is arranged, that it becomes the key element that contains the information. So, there are some cells in which you can, with relatively small effort, move the position of an atom from one location to a slightly different location. And as long as you can sense this change, then, you have information stored in this location. And so the optics have changed completely from moving large quantity of objects to really looking at the intrinsic property of the objects. And the main question is, are these small changes, can they be sensed? And these are stable at room temperature. Can they stay in that position once you place them there for the usual, 10 years or so forth that we specify our components? And so these ingredients, were known in the past, but we have never gotten to the point of thinking of using them as a specific element to store information. And see, we have somewhat become the new alchemists. We can now manipulate something at the atomic level, and can we use that information, like we are using now the thousands of electrons that are stored in one transistor on the adjacent one, as the key element to make computation and storage of memory.
Dr. Buryanov, what future do you see right now for nanotechnology, and especially in the field of your research?
Well, as Dr. Garjini mentioned, the semiconductor industry has been in the era of nanotechnology for at least the year 2000. And to speak of the future of nanotechnology, well, the future is now, basically. And we're encountering those nanoscopic effects every day, and we're dealing with those. Things such as quantum mechanical tunneling, such as things as quantum confinement, where when you confine a system in small dimensions, it is discrete. There's discrete behavior starts becoming evident. And we've been dealing with that for a number of years. As we go forward, the change will be manipulating smaller and smaller groups of atoms or groups of electrons and basically obtaining some novel behavior that we know about but we don't currently utilize. And, you know, that, like I say, will hopefully allow the industry to continue scaling. The idea of every increment in time, every 2 years, we bring out products which are faster, they use less energy, and they take up less space. So I do think that nanotechnology already has allowed us to do that. And as we go forward, it will allow us to do more of that, although the fundamental building blocks that we're manipulating will no longer be groups of hundreds or thousands of electrons, but instead are groups of a dozen or a relatively small number of atoms or electrons that are basically interacting with each other and have a collective behavior that we can then sense and manipulate externally.
Drs. Garjini and Boryanov, thank you very much for taking this time out to speak with me today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Intel scientists Paolo Garjini and George Boryanov on quantum computing. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.